this, well, for the festivities and be able to, you know, buy the presents for the kids and for the Christmas and New Year dinner and clothes. So this is actually the first topic of conversation you're going to find. And maybe the question of what the U.S. is going to do comes maybe a third, as a third question. So the thing is that they need, as it has been proven, and they rely strongly, not on, this is what the think tank documents show, and other also several statements, they really rely on the fact that something needs to happen inside Venezuela in order to ease up the current clear regime change operation that's been going. This has not happened. So this is why they are stopping the notch a bit more and raising the volume higher as possible in order to see what kind of reactions this brings. Yesterday's raid of a Venezuelan tanker also shows, it's quite descriptive in several ways, but it shows precisely how this could be a very childish way to find and some sort of reaction that would follow us, provoke some sort of, you know, casus belli of any kind in order to escalate quicker and to do the bid for the United States in that sense. And this has not been the case. So the escalation continues, but still the focus and the reliance, as we could see, because otherwise we would have seen some different maneuver like kinetic action, but this has not been the case. So they're really relying on what happens inside Venezuela, and they're really relying for us to do their bidding.
Thank you, Diego. And Gloria, I'm glad Diego mentioned the tanker, how he perceives what the seizure of the tanker was meant to convey. I want to get exactly your thoughts on this. This oil tanker seized, Venezuelan tanker, very unusual in that it was a merchant oil tanker seized by U.S. Naval authorities. What is it meant to convey? Is it some kind of threat, an act of intimidation, just blatant piracy? Trump says, jokingly, oh, we'll probably keep the oil. Okay, whatever. I mean, is that why the U.S. is down there in the first place? Is this a prelude that the U.S. wants Venezuelan oil? Because this is kind of out of step with what the Trump administration was doing up until now, supposedly down there for the illicit drug trade. And now with this oil tanker, it's a switching gears. How do you perceive it?
The announcement yesterday by Trump, sort of offhand comment, was meant to convey that the U.S. can do whatever it wants. President Trump can do whatever he wants in the most arrogant way. Oh, yes, I think we'll keep the ship, and there'll be more seizures. That's what an unnamed U.S. official said. Attorney General Pam Bondi yesterday declared that it had something to do with state terrorism. This is a complete lie. The U.S. has blocked and sanctioned very heavily Cuba, Iran, and North Korea, but in particular Iran and Cuba, declaring Cuba a state sponsor of terrorism in order to create this whole atmosphere of illegality, which in fact the U.S. is a terrorist in this action, in these blockades. And the fact that the ship was heading toward Cuba, we need to understand that it's also an attack and a threat on Cuba, which is really suffering great shortages in oil to run its thermoelectric plants, its energy. And this is what Rubio and Trump said in the first term, that we're going to bring down Venezuela, Cuba, and Nicaragua. It's a very real threat. And yet what they're frustrated by is that the people of Venezuela, I appreciate Diego Sequeira's comments about the feelings of the people in Venezuela. He's on the ground. He knows what he's talking about. I think the mobilization of the militias is a message to the U.S. You are not going to have an easy way if you dare to attack our country. And that's why I think I, as an activist of the Answer Coalition and other groups, we believe that it's necessary for the people of the U.S., those of us who are in the country that's waging this war, we have to be active in the streets along with people around the world. And also the awarding of this war prize, it's not a peace prize in the Nobel Peace Prize. The rewarding to Corina Machado, to the one who is calling for U.S. invasion, begging the U.S. to invade, begging the U.S. to overthrow President Maduro. It has brought a lot of protests in Norway and other places as well. It's a sham. And we must bring out this hypocrisy. Trump just pardoned the ex-president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, for having brought in 400 tons of cocaine to the U.S. It's really about the oil that Venezuela possesses that belongs to the people. It's also the example that Venezuela provides to Latin America and really the world. What you can do when the people have its own resources for itself and for others in solidarity. This is dangerous to the United States because we're suffering the greatest economic crisis of the people of the U.S., where the wealth is being transferred to the billionaire class. We're suffering healthcare costs. We're suffering housing costs. And we're suffering joblessness. It's a war on the people at home. It's a war on the people abroad. And the example of Venezuela is important for us and why we must defend its right to its independence and its sovereignty.
Thank you, Gloria. And Diego, I want to come back to you. We've seen the U.S. president time and again condemn socialism and the socialist and left-leaning leaders and administrations in Central and South America. Is Donald Trump concerned, from your perspective, to export democracy to the Venezuelan people? And if not, then what is his dislike of Nicolas Maduro born of or based out of or based on?
Sometimes I have, if you peruse the literature of his first term in office by persons like Mark Esper, the former Secretary of Defense, he basically tells the story about how Trump came to the conclusion that Maduro was the actual strong leader, and Juan Guaido was, remember Juan Guaido, I guess, was the wimpy-ish character here, and how he was basically conned by the Venezuelan opposition back then. So, regardless of, yes, a clear, automatic, predictable, anti-communist, antique, and also Cold War relic in the ways that they address Venezuela, the problem is not only the example that Gloria just described, especially on sovereignty, independence, and resistance, it is also the living proof within the hemisphere of how even a very draconian sanctions regime that won't necessarily succeed in any of their principal aims, regardless of the harm that they have achieved in over a decade. So this is also part of the problem. Not only that, there's other reasons here. This is, yes, of course it's about the oil, and yes, this of course is about regime-changing Venezuela as ASAP, as soon as possible, in order to further what actually is on the menu overall, which is a regional change, a hemispheric war, and pushing out, expelling the multipolar players within the region, within the Western Hemisphere. So it is clearly stated now in its current, recently released national security strategy. They even revamped in a very dumb way, I think, the Monroe Doctrine, and they just concede to Trump the Trump corollary and so on, in order to precisely prove that this is the doctrine. And everything that we've seen regarding the drugs and all the, or the political or the criminal spins are not succeeding. And this brings then the need to try to shift the narrative as they are trying right now, because everybody sees through it.
And thank you, Diego. Let me put that same question. Ms. Lariva, we've seen different U.S. presidents and administrations concerned with getting democracy to the people of Afghanistan, of Iraq, of Iran. They time and again have said of Syria, of Lebanon. And now we hear U.S. President Donald Trump time and again speak also about how Venezuela needs to do away with the socialist leader and pave way for democracy. How concerned do you think this particular president is now with this age-old exporting democracy to Caracas?
The fact that the United States has financed Israel to murder what may be 100,000 people, half of them children and women, for the last 2 years, really exposes the lie when the U.S. talks about democracy. The word democracy is used to cover its real aim, geopolitical domination in the Middle East, and now shifting to Latin America, but of course not giving up on its support for the genocide that Israel is carrying out. The world sees the hypocrisy, sees the lies, and it's time for us to strip away what this is really about. Trump says it himself in the Trump corollary that Diego mentioned, which basically says, literally, the resources of Latin America belong to us. Nobody can challenge that. It's the Monroe Doctrine on steroids. It's very, very serious. You know, it takes about 2 weeks for oil from the Middle East to reach the United States. It takes less than 20 hours to reach Houston, one of the main refinery sources. Citgo oil, which belongs to Venezuela, is right now on the chopping block, ready to be sold these very days. And it's theft that began several years ago, and of course began under President Obama when he declared in 2015 for Venezuela to be an extraordinary threat to United States security. This is part of what U.S. imperialism is about. It's never allowing any country, first of all, to be economically challenged, but it's also about the resources. Venezuela has 303 billion barrels of oil that it knows of right now. The next country is 267 billion barrels of Saudi Arabia. Venezuela has far more oil than anyone in the world. The United States has 55 billion barrels of oil in reserve or known resources. That's a far cry from what Venezuela has. It's about oil. It's about example. Because of people who are homeless here, the middle class, which is suffering, having to pay mortgage of decades, and they knew what the resources used for the people of Venezuela are for. Just to mention 5.5 million homes, they might start thinking, we need a change in this country, in the United States, and people are already thinking that.
Okay,
and acting.
Thank you, ma'am. Diego, Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat out of Maryland, said that U.S. seizing the oil tanker has cast doubt over the administration's stated reason for the military buildup and the boat strikes. He says that this shows that their entire cover story, that this is about interdicting drugs, is a big lie. That this is just one more piece of evidence that is what it's really about is regime change by force. And my question to you, between Texas and Venezuela, there are a number of countries alleged to be involved in the cocaine, the heroin, the meth and fentanyl pipeline. So one has to ask, why skip all of these and go all the way down to Caracas if you're really after drugs? And if you're not, if you're after regime change, my ultimate question, because we don't have much time, I want to put this question to both of you, if we could, over the next couple of minutes. What would regime change look like in Caracas to you, Diego? Who wins, who loses, and what does this mean for the people of Venezuela, their stability, and their security moving forward?
Regardless of what the U.S. does, they have already lost. There is no possible direction other than rational dialogue, which is not on the table, in which they don't will receive significant blowback, be it a military attack of any nature, be it not doing anything and showing its internal weakness, or the vulnerabilities that actually this kind of adventure has, and it's harmful for its own population. Hard to predict which one's going to be, but one thing is for sure in that sense, which is basically it hasn't and will not succeed because of blowback and because of the massive amount of blowback that this will ensue. Just think about it. A couple of months ago, because of the speculation of an attack, West Texas was surging dramatically. And this, of course, would have an impact on fuel prices inside the United States. So it shows how self-destructive actually this kind of operation is. So regardless of what it does, it won't succeed, in spite of what happens to us, I might add.
And final thoughts with you, Ms. Lariva. Gloria, what does regime change spell for you in Caracas due to Venezuela as a nation? What does it do for the U.S. in the short and long term? And how do you see it impacting the dynamics of the neighborhood of Colombia, Brazil, Trinidad, Tobago, Guyana, and all the peripheral countries there in the area?
The ongoing legacy of the Bolivarian Republic that began with Hugo Chavez is not about one man. It's not about Hugo Chavez or Maduro. It is about a country of a people, despite the fact that there is a lot of polemical division between the people, those who are rich, those who feel that they gain by the U.S. coming in. But the masses of people who I have come to know over my 25 years of visiting Venezuela, being there on the ground, they're not going to give up what they've gained. And yet, U.S. has not won a war in many decades, but they've caused mass destruction. Millions of people have died from Iraq to Libya to Yugoslavia, where I saw the NATO bombing while I was there, and it will be the same for Latin America. This is extremely dangerous for the whole region. The U.S. really wants to do away with the Cuban Revolution, and for them, it's a race for time. They want to do this during Trump's administration. They want to change the whole form of government of the U.S. to be one far more dictatorial, where the presidential power is in the hands of Trump. They're trying to do away with everything that we achieved in the 30s and the 60s of our social struggles. But what they want to do in Venezuela will be an utter disaster for the region, but I am confident that the Venezuelan people will be victorious in defending their homeland. And we need to convey that to our people, that we do not want a war. Peace, we must stop the war before it starts.
And thank you both for joining us in the program. Time has gone the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Our guests there, Diego Sequeira, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Caracas, and also Gloria Lariva, Latin American expert, joining us out of San Francisco, California. And this brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
Humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salam alaikum. This is Hussein, and you're listening to your program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In this program, we talk about Islamic teachings and Quranic elements pertaining to humanity and mankind. And in the previous episodes, we started covering a very good book in this regard, titled A 250-Year-Old Person, or A 250-Year-Old Man, which is a combination of the lectures delivered by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei about the life stories and biographies of the great leaders of Islam, the Prophet of Islam, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and the successors of the Prophet from among his pure progeny. So we were talking about the challenges that the Prophet ﷺ had throughout his years as the leader of the community, and also his personal characteristics. And we talked about the triumphant return of the Prophet to the Mecca, and how he showed love and forgiveness, not just by words, but by actions, especially when he was the most powerful person. He forgave all those people who had killed his close relatives, like his uncle Hamza and other people. And he taught Muslims for eternity that forgiveness comes before everything else. Now, another incident that took place in the final year of the Prophet of Islam was the incident of Ghadir al-Khum. Now, the incident of Ghadir has one Shi'i aspect that in Shi'a Islam is studied, but because it's an incident in the life of the Prophet of Islam, Muslims cannot just ignore it in general. And it has a role to play for the overall ideology of Islam. Now, before the Ghadir, we should contextualize, we should put in context Ghadir. Before the Ghadir, the Prophet of Islam, he performed Hajjatul Wida, the last Hajj performed by the Prophet ﷺ. And in that Hajj, in that pilgrimage to Mecca, the Prophet of Islam taught Muslims everything they needed about the rituals of the pilgrimage. And in Mina, in one of the ritualistic stays throughout the process of Hajj, he delivered two sermons. Okay, there is the Sermon of Mina, but the most accurate account is that he delivered two sermons in Mina, one on around the day 10th of the Hajjah, and the other after Ayyam al-Tashriq, which would be around the 13th of the Hajjah. Okay, so, and when we analyze these two sermons, we realize that it has a great political and social connotation in it. These sermons have been transmitted in both Shia and Sunni sources of hadith. So he starts talking about jihad, about the struggles in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he would say that the struggle against pagans continues until that everyone accepts monotheism. And this is not just a matter of like temporary matter. The struggle continues as long as there is oppression. The struggle continues as long as there are ideologies that would enslave people. Pagan ideologies are like that. Pagan ideologies are the basis for the enslavement and oppression against people. And if you remember, in one episode we said that all the oppressions and all the injustice throughout history, they originate from wrong ideologies. And when we talk about Tawheed, we want to ultimately establish justice, because everything else other than true Tawheed would enable and would justify oppression and injustice. Okay, we're gonna have a break and we come back to continue the discussion.
الزهراء والحسن الرحيم
welcome back. We were talking about the sermons of Mina delivered by the Prophet, and this is For Humanity from IRIB English Radio, and you're listening to your program. Now, the topics that the Prophet covers in the Sermon of Mina, we said that one of them was the struggle. The next is the unity among Muslims, that Muslims should not engage in civil war, that the sanctity of the blood of a Muslim is emphasized there. This is a people that it was possible that they would immediately go back to their default tribal system, okay, because I'm from this tribe, you're from that tribe, we have a fort. No. According to Islam, all Muslims are equal, and you do not have the right to start a wage war based on those things. So, about the values of the era of ignorance, era of Jahiliyyah. Now, this is a challenge that the revolutions have, that after a while, people start going backward, irtija or irtidad, they start going back to the values of the era of the pre-revolution era, okay? And for the people of Arabian Peninsula, it was very possible that this short time, although the Prophet spent a lot of energy and time educating people, teaching them about the values of Islam and everything, still it was possible that they forget. If you have been trained and raised in an environment for 40 years and those habits and customs and values that have persisted over centuries, right? So it's very difficult to change them in a matter of 20 years, 15 years, 10 years. So that's why the Prophet would always leave a mark that you should not go back. You should not. And the values of the era of Jahiliyyah are all under my feet. The values based on, I don't know, tribal affiliation, about the financial positions of people and everything. Ala wa kullu ma'tharatin fil jahiliyyah tahta qadamay hatayn. Anything remaining from the era of Jahiliyyah are under my feet. They have no value. Now we have set a new system of value in Islam, which is based on piety, which is based on obedience to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And those privileges, those things that you thought if you're born in this tribe, you have privileges. And in our time, you would say sometimes these things exist. Like, for example, if you're from that nation, by default, people respect you more. If you're from that, I don't know, community, you have more chances of having a job. If you're, no. All of these are wrong. All of these are new forms of Jahiliyyah and the era of ignorance, tribal affiliations or tribal mentality in a different form, in the name of nationalism or in the name of other things. People should only be valued based on their performance, based on things that is under their control, not the things that are out of their control. Okay, so this is just some of the topics covered in the Sermon of Mina. Inshallah, in the next episode, we're going to cover other topics that the Prophet ﷺ talks about in the Sermon of Mina. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Jannah, it's all I ever wish for. This life is not eternal, but the next will last forever. Jannah, it's all I ever wish for.
Of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother.
picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. And here I lay at home tonight. It's late but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. Taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, you listen with patience. That's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say good night. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry if my love is unkind. I just have to let you know you're so precious. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan. Now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. I'm left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not enough that life is tough when there's no one to call my mother, my sweet mother. My sweet mother.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
As the U.S. closes door, China is opening new ones and redefining Africa's place in the world. There is talk of the continent turning Trump's punitive tariffs into a new opportunity. Now, will Africa rise to reshape its destiny, or will it be left behind in the global power struggle? And joining us today to discuss this important topic is Irete Bakara Yusuf. Now, she is a broadcast journalist and founder of African Journalists Against Genocide. Also with us today is Zizwe Chiguka. Now, he is the organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party and the African Party for the Independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. Join us for this week's edition of Africa Today as we discuss how African countries can turn Trump's punitive tariffs into an opportunity. When the United States raised tariffs on African exports to as high as 30% in the case of South Africa, shockwaves rippled across the continent. Overnight, billions in trade were at risk. Uganda, Gabon, and Niger had already lost their duty-free access under a U.S. program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act. For many, it felt like punishment, but for Africa, it could be a wake-up call. Because while Washington is shutting doors, Beijing is opening. By 2024, Africa-China trade had surged past $295 billion. In just the first 5 months of 2025, it added another $134 billion. Factories, ports, and railways financed by China are changing the way Africa connects with the world. At the same time, African nations are rethinking their own future. The African Continental Free Trade Area is laying the foundations for the world's largest single market. Across the continent, a new spirit of self-reliance is taking hold. Now, these tariffs aren't just about economics. They are moves in a global power struggle over currencies, over alliances, over the future of trade itself. Now the question is, will Africa turn exclusion into power and claim its place in the new multipolar world order?
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently addressed a virtual BRICS leaders' extraordinary summit that focused on the current economic environment and the state of the multilateral system. Now, commenting on the tariffs war imposed by the U.S., he said that we are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges and opportunities. Let's take a listen.
We are witnessing seismic shifts in global trade that present both challenges as well as opportunities in the reordering of the global economy. There is a shift from a unipolar to a multipolar world. This moment is marked by intensifying global competition and growing geopolitical tensions. Unilateral tariff actions are contributing to an increasingly protectionist environment, which poses great hardships and danger for the countries of the global south. The uncertainty of the new trading regime has already negatively affected employment levels in my own country, South Africa, and is an obstacle to our economic growth. We are therefore supportive of meaningful BRICS initiatives that improve the resilience of our economies as BRICS countries.
Well, the South African president, they are speaking of new opportunities for Africa amid the trade war imposed by the U.S. president on Africa. Now, let's start off with Ireti Bakare Yusuf. Given the recent discussions surrounding the tariffs imposed on African exports by the U.S., do you believe Africa should view these as an opportunity to reduce its reliance on Western markets?
I think it's important that Africa begins to actually take control and steer and sort of pull away more and more from its dependency on Western markets. Why is that? Because Africa needs to realize the only way that Africa can grow is to continue or begin to do more and more business with the within themselves, within Africa, across the region, and, you know, pull away from the powers that the Western region had over Africa. Indeed, the only way we can actually begin to see a growth, and if you like, a Viva Africa, and a fully independent Africa, an Africa that works for Africans, and indeed her massive youth, is to actually continue to do business.
Thank you. Now, let's bring in Zizwe Chibuka. Do you think Africa's ongoing efforts to reduce reliance on the U.S. through initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area will help shield the continent from the impacts of a U.S. trade war?
The Africa Free Trade Agreement will definitely help to buffer the African nation states against the tariff policies of the current U.S. administration, basically because Africa is the richest continent on earth, and the economies of Africa, they need to be integrated so that they're not so dependent on foreign direct investment or foreign markets. Many of the nation states in Africa are dependent upon U.S. foreign market for sales. But if we integrate the economies of Africa, and the African Free Trade Agreement is a step in that direction, we will become less dependent upon the U.S. economy as a foreign market.
President Donald Trump's aggressive tariff policies, particularly the imposition of reciprocal tariffs of up to 50% on imports from countries with trade surpluses with the U.S., have significantly disrupted global trade dynamics. African nations heavily reliant on U.S. markets for exports like textiles, agriculture, and minerals have been among the most affected. In response, many are actively seeking new markets across Asia to mitigate the adverse economic impacts.
President Trump's recent decision to exempt key African minerals like gold, tungsten, uranium, and graphite from U.S. tariffs has raised questions about the underlying motives of these trade policies. Now, the administration justifies these exemptions as necessary to secure critical supply chains vital for sectors like aerospace, electronics, and energy. Now, Mr. Chiguka, how do you interpret this move?
The Trump administration could not put tariffs on those rare earth minerals because of the need for those rare earth minerals. It's the same thing in Africa. There are certain things, mineral resources, like uranium, coltan, etc. The administration in the U.S. cannot afford to put tariffs on those kinds of things because of the need. So they take people as food, basically, when they have these economic arrangements and negotiations with other countries. And it's also a result of colonialism in the past in Africa that the U.S. government is able to bully people in Africa, the governments in Africa, in terms of making these arrangements to the detriment of the economy of the African nation states. So unification is the key. The integration of the African economy will stop all of those problems that the colonialists and imperialists are trying to impose on the African nation states.
Thanks for that, Mr. Chiguka. Let's now take a short break before we continue our discussion on punitive U.S. tariffs on Africa and how they can be turned into an opportunity for the continent. Stay with us.
Trump's tariffs, Africa's opportunity.
The African Continental Free Trade Area stands as a cornerstone of Africa's development vision under Agenda 2063. Now, a unified market holds immense potential, unlocking boundless opportunities for the continent's growth and prosperity. The Secretary General of this Pan-African body elaborates on the opportunities.
By the year 2035, the AFCFTA market, the combined GDP of the AFCFTA market is estimated to be close to $7 trillion United States dollars. That means that there are opportunities for small medium enterprises, for young entrepreneurs, to export across regions of the African continent and to take advantage of this vast market. However, if we don't have an integrated single market, we will not be able to achieve the positive projections that many around the world have made about the potential of the AFCFTA.
Well, as Africa continues to develop its economic strategies, initiatives like the African Continental Free Trade Area are undermining the U.S. Multilateral trade frameworks with Africa, such as the so-called African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. This is seen by many as presenting an opportunity for Africa to push for stronger economic integration within the continent itself. Ms. Bakare Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, AGOA, really, yes, Nigeria, my country, was one of the largest users, if not the largest users of AGOA, but, you know, that no longer exists. And again, AGOA was just a way of, you know, it was the American soft power way of controlling African countries. So certainly we should get away. And I can't say, I mean, I can honestly say for myself, I am one of those who sees this as a great, great opportunity for Africa to free itself of the American stronghold. But the question is Africa ready? They need our resources. The same President Trump that's imposing tariffs on South Africa, on Nigeria, etc., that's weaponizing tariffs, is actually, they need the rare earth. He's talking about, oh, I'm stopping the war in Congo, you know, in exchange for natural resources. Well, he hasn't even stopped any war, but I have no doubt he's probably signed the natural resource and how to steal from Congo, how to steal from Sudan, how to steal from Nigeria, heck, how to steal from as many parts of Africa as possible. And those are the things that we need to stop from happening. If African countries had led the initiative and ensured that the war in Congo, the genocide going on, is actually stopped and they're able to get there and stop it, talk to their brother leaders, put a stop to it, then we wouldn't have had a President Trump who would be able to interlude and claim that he stopped a war, which he hasn't stopped. I must keep saying that. He hasn't stopped. What he did was to sign a contract to collect more minerals, to steal, not collect, to actually thieve and steal more minerals from Africa in the future, in order to tell to do a ceasefire that only lasted a few days.
The exclusion of African countries from AGOA presents a significant new opportunity for the continent to reconsider and potentially break free from trade agreements that may have restricted its long-term growth and potential. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how has AGOA's narrow focus on specific industries and reliance on external partners hindered the continent's ability to diversify its economies and pursue more self-sustaining models of development?
I definitely think that this is an opportunity for Africa to unify economically, politically, socially. On the economic front, the African Growth and Opportunities Act was a thing that was used by the imperialist powers to keep a dependency relationship of these newly independent African states. So this would work in our favor to spark a change in Africa to further integrate the African economy. And so the U.S. administration is helping to mobilize our people for greater forms, levels of unity on the economic front. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing that they are actually trying to impose these tariffs. So now we can integrate our economies and be less dependent on the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which is to the disfavor of the African nation states anyway.
China's expanding influence in Africa represents a significant shift from the historically exploitative engagement of Western powers, particularly the United States. Many analysts view the increasing trade between China and African nations as a constructive alternative to the punitive tariffs often associated with U.S. economic policy.
There's a China-Africa summit every year in which the Chinese forgive the debt of many African nation states. And also China has helped to build infrastructure projects throughout Africa, such as the Trans-Am Railroad back in the 70s. So that relationship with China has always been a positive and is increasingly becoming even better with their help financially and economically, so that we're less dependent upon the U.S. and the European imperialists that charge astronomical interest rates on these loans that they give us. Because if you look at all the nation states in Africa that have taken out International Monetary Fund loans, they're still paying the interest and they can't even get to the principal. So therefore, the indebtedness of African nation states to IMF is continuing to rise, whereas China is helping and forgives many of the loans so that we can become less dependent on the International Monetary Fund in Africa.
In response to the U.S.'s aggressive trade policy, there is a growing argument for African countries to focus on de-dollarization and create more independent trade structures within the global south. Now, Mr. Chibuka, how can de-dollarization and the establishment of independent trade structures help African countries mitigate the impact of external economic pressures such as an aggressive trade policy from the U.S.
Therefore, it is incumbent upon Africa to take this opportunity to break away from the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar was the reserve currency and is steadily declining in terms of nation states that are dependent on the U.S. dollar. So this is an opportunity for Africa to become less dependent and use the mechanism of de-dollarization through the BRICS Alliance and other mechanisms, so that when the U.S. dollar declines, finally, it won't affect Africa as much. It won't be as disruptive, because the handwriting is on the wall for the U.S. dollar. It is declining on a global scale, and the African nations have to be able to adjust, or they will go down if they keep dependency on the U.S. dollar. Therefore, de-dollarization is a must in Africa.
South Africa has been hit hard by the Trump tariffs. The ANC-led coalition government has struggled to restore respond effectively. While some critics argue that South Africa's response lacked urgency or forcefulness, especially given the economic stakes, Pretoria has clearly taken diplomatic and strategic steps.
Ms. Bakare Yusuf will have the last word today. Now, what steps should African governments take to ensure that they are better prepared for such economic shocks in future?
We wait, like I said earlier, we wait on the until the problem lands in our country, slaps us in the face before we start to respond. Why isn't there anybody looking to the future and planning? That is what African countries must do. African leaders must start to look, visionize a really strong and independent Africa and continue to plan, not just plan, implement, not just implement, create the structure, the framework, the foundation to build that vision on. But you can't do that again if you don't invest in your education. So now we come to social structure. You've got to invest in your education because you have to be ready to pass on the baton to the next generation. Yet again, we've got the likes of Paul Biya, who are wanting to run again and again and again. So the youth, of course, they feel despondent. They're in despair. They don't see a future.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs to have visionary leaders and invest in education for the continent to be free of manipulation by the likes of Trump. I'd like to thank our guests today, Iwechi Bakare Yusuf and Zizwe Chibuka, for their incisive analysis. Now let's proceed to the next part of our program, honoring Africa's remarkable civilizations, which are the cornerstone of its vibrant cultural legacy. In today's fast-evolving world, it's increasingly important for young Africans to reconnect with their heritage. Now, preserving this identity is key to shaping a confident and empowered future. My colleague, Janet Ali, will share more on this.
Hello, I'm Janet Ali, and welcome to a series of programs that will delve into some of the ancient African civilizations. As Africa moves to become a focal point of the world's economy, reflecting on the continent's rich civilization is critical to preserve its pure identity. Today, let us get to know more about the Songhai civilization. Songhai Empire, one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in West African history. This civilization emerged in the 15th century and was centered around the Niger River. The empire's capital was the city of Gao, but it's also included other significant cities like Timbuktu and Djenne. The rise of the Songhai Empire began under the leadership of Sunni Ali in the 1460s. Sunni Ali expanded the empire's territories through military conquests and established control over crucial trade routes. His successor, Askia Muhammad, further centralized the administration, promoting Islam and implementing a legal system based on Islamic law. Under Askia Muhammad's rule, the empire experienced a golden age marked by political stability, economic prosperity, and cultural flourishing. The Songhai Empire's achievements were numerous. Timbuktu and Djenne became renowned centers of learning, attracting scholars and students from across the Islamic world. The empire's wealth was built on trans-Saharan trade dealing in gold, salt, and other valuable commodities. The Songhai military was also formidable, utilizing cavalry and riverine forces to maintain control over their vast territories. However, the decline of the Songhai Empire began in the late 16th century. Internal strife and succession disputes weakened the central authority. 1591, the Moroccan army invaded the Songhai Empire equipped with firearms, which gave them a significant advantage over the Songhai forces. The Battle of Tombili marked the end of Songhai dominance, and the empire gradually fragmented into smaller states. Despite its decline, the legacy of Songhai civilization still endures. Efforts to preserve the heritage of the Songhai include protecting historical sites like the Sankore Madrasa in Timbuktu, a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Timbuktu's ancient manuscripts, which contain invaluable knowledge on various subjects, are being digitized and preserved to safeguard the cultural and intellectual achievements of the Songhai era. That was a brief description of the Songhai civilization. From me, Jannat Ali, it's goodbye.
Well, and that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. On behalf of the entire crew, it's me, Mubarak Kenya, saying goodbye for now.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran, the beautiful capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In Islam, the ink of the scholar is more holy than the blood of the martyr. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to the birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. And here's what's awaiting you on your radio station. Don't miss a beat. First, we have a new segment of radio productions. We hope these diverse and engaging pieces have provided you with enjoyment and insight throughout our broadcast. As we continue, we return to the profound wisdom of Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul with the spring of truth. Following that, we dive back into another segment of radio productions. Then we open the gate of knowledge. Sheikh Mustafa Mukhtar will explain and illustrate the profound moral, ethical, spiritual, and social teachings found within the Nahjul Balagha, a perfect way to continue the day with profound wisdom. After this, we have Round the World with reporters. Coming up next, another exciting chapter from our radio productions right here on Iran Radio. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome to Women of Resistance. Ahlam Akram Thabit is a teacher in Gaza who has survived the pain and atrocities of a genocide. She says she sees pain and fear in the eyes of her young students, but she also sees hope and resilience because she says as Palestinians, they are dreamers, thinkers, and fighters. Here is more of Ahlam.
Palestine is global, but those whose family left the soil only to later return with their own families, they have a unique perspective and have brought back much needed sets of talents and skills.
This is Ahlam Akram Thabit. I'm a proud Palestinian from Gaza. I was born in United Arab Emirates and I lived there for 18 years. Then I have done my early studies, I moved to Gaza to complete my higher education. So I studied English language and its teaching methods at Qutb University of Gaza. And soon, inshallah, I'm going to have my master's, because education is not just a profession for me,